You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2, The National Socialist Movement. When I was still an instructor for the military troops, I delivered my first lecture on the Peace Treaty of Versailles. After that experience, I altered my speech by calling it the Peace Treaties of Brest-Litovsk and Versailles. As I learned from the discussion after my first lecture, people knew nothing whatsoever about the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, but they had been indoctrinated by their party's skilled propaganda machine to ridicule this treaty because they were taught it was one of the world's most shameful acts of rape that Germany had committed against Russia. The constant insistence of this lie meant that millions of Germans saw the Peace Treaty of Versailles as the revenge for the crime we had committed at Brest-Litovsk. And they felt that any struggle against Versailles was a moral outrage. They were often deeply honest in this belief. This was one of the reasons why the disrespectful and horrible word reparations was adopted into Germany's language. This hypocritical lie seemed to be a fulfillment of higher justice to millions of our misled fellow nationals. It was horrible, but that is what they believed. The best proof of this was the success of the propaganda I initiated against the Peace Treaty of Versailles, which was now introduced by a discussion of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. I compared the two peace treaties point by point and showed how absolutely humane Brest-Litovsk was when compared to the inhuman cruelty of the Versailles Treaty. My success was incredible. I then spoke on that subject in meetings of 2,000 people, where I was often met by 3,600 hostile eyes. 3 hours later, I would have in front of me a surging crowd filled with solid resentment, righteous anger, and absolute rage. Once again, a great lie had been uprooted from the hearts and minds of a crowd of thousands, and a truth planted in its place. At that time, the true causes of the First World War and the peace treaties of Brest-Litovsk and Versailles were the two lectures I considered my most important ones. I repeated them dozens of times in various ways until a clear and unified attitude was established among the first members of the movement. For me, these meetings had another advantage. I gradually became a mass meeting speaker and grew skillful in evoking feelings and developing gestures that are needed in a great room holding thousands of people. Except for some small circles, no one seemed to understand the need for good speech-making skills. Many of those parties now throw out their chests and act as if they were the ones responsible for the change in public opinion. If a so-called nationalist speaker did give a similar lecture somewhere, it was only for groups that already shared his opinion and at best did nothing more than reinforce their existing beliefs. There was no need to convince those who were already believers. What was more important was to use explanations and propaganda to recruit those who were on the enemy's side of the fence as a result of their training and opinions. We used leaflets to explain this. While I was still in the army, I had written a leaflet that compared the peace treaties of Brest-Litovsk and Versailles. That leaflet was widely distributed. Later, I used elements of it for the party, and it proved to be very effective. The first party meetings were memorable because the tables were covered with all kinds of leaflets, newspapers, and pamphlets. Even then, however, the main emphasis was on the spoken word. Only the spoken word is capable of producing truly great revolutions, and this is based on sound psychological reasons. As I have said before, every great and world-shaking event has been produced by the spoken word and not by the written word. This claim was followed by a long discussion in some of the press. They naturally took a very sharp stand against my assertion, especially the privileged class Smart Alex. The reason for this confused many of my skeptics. The privileged class intellects protested my confidence in the power of public speaking because they lacked the strength and ability to influence the masses with the spoken word. They concentrated on purely literary activities, abandoning the real campaigner's weapon of public speaking. The necessary result of this habit led to what distinguishes our privileged class today. They lost the instinct needed to influence or motivate the masses. The speaker receives constant feedback from the crowd he is speaking to, and he can constantly judge from the faces of his audience whether they understand his message, and if his words are having the desired effect on them. The writer does not know his readers at all. Therefore, he will not address any specific group of people, but will keep his writing general. Writing in this way causes him to lose the psychological delicacy and adaptability he needs. In general, a brilliant speaker will write better than a brilliant writer can speak unless he too practices the art of speaking constantly. There is also the fact that the masses of people are lazy by nature. They will not pick up and read something unless it goes along with their own existing beliefs or offers what they hope for. Therefore, a written work about a specific issue is usually only read by people who already belong to that movement. A poster or a leaflet may be short enough to be read quickly by one who thinks differently. There is a better chance for response from a picture in all its forms, up to and including the motion pictures or movies. Here, man depends even less on his brain. It is enough simply to look or, at most, read very short captions. Many people are much more willing to take in a pictorial representation than to read a longer written work. The explanation a picture can give in one quick look would require a lot of tedious reading. So a picture is worth 1,000 words. The most essential point is that you never know whose hands the written material will fall into, and no matter who picks it up, its form remains the same. In general, it will be more effective if this form agrees with the intellectual level and character of those who are reading it. A book intended for the broad masses must, from the start, use a different style and mental level than would be used in a work destined for readers in the higher intellectual classes. Written matter approaches the spoken word only when it is adapted to exactly match the audience. The speaker may discuss the same topic as a book, but if he is a great and inspired speaker, he will rarely repeat the same argument twice in the same way. He will always allow himself to be influenced by the listeners, so that his feelings will give him precisely the words he needs to move his audience at that moment. If he makes even the slightest mistake, he has a living admonishment constantly in front of him. As mentioned earlier, he can read from the expressions of his listeners to see whether, firstly, they understand what he is saying, secondly, whether they can follow it, and thirdly, how completely they are convinced of the truth of what they hear. If he firstly sees that they do not understand him, he will make his explanation so simple and plain that even the dullest among them can grasp it. Secondly, if he feels that they cannot follow him, he will build up his ideas so carefully and slowly that even the feeblest among the crowd is not left behind. If he thirdly suspects that they do not seem convinced of the truth of what he says, he will go on repeating those truths with new illustrations, addressing the unspoken objections he can sense, disproving and shattering them until finally the attitude and expression of even the last opposing group shows it has surrendered to his arguments. With human beings, it is frequently a matter of overcoming prejudices that are not founded on reason, but supported only by feeling, Many times, these feelings are deep in the unconscious mind. Overcoming this barrier of instinctive dislike, emotional hatred, and pre-existing objections is 1,000 times harder to correct than a belief based on faulty facts or mistaken opinion. False ideas and incorrect facts can be eliminated by instruction, but emotional resistances cannot. Only an appeal to these mysterious forces themselves can be effective. Such an appeal can rarely be made by the writer, but almost exclusively by the speaker. We can see the most striking proof of this in the privileged class press. Even with their skillful writing and multi-million reader circulation, they were not able to stop the great masses from becoming bitter enemies of the privileged class world. The flood of newspapers and books produced year after year by the intellectual crowd simply beaded up and flowed off the millions of the lower classes like water off oiled leather. This proves either of two things. Either it proves the writing of our privileged class world used the wrong arguments, or it proves the hearts of the broad masses cannot be reached by writing alone, especially when the writing has so little psychological appeal, as is the case here. Never let it be said that this statement is disproved by Marxism itself just because it produces many writings, especially because of the effect of the writings by Karl Marx. A great German nationalist paper in Berlin tried to make this argument. Probably a more shallow defense of a flawed view has never been attempted. What has given Marxism its astonishing power over the broad masses is not the formal written product of Jewish brains, but the enormous wave of speeches filled with propaganda that have taken possession of the masses through the years. Out of 100,000 German workers, on average, not 100 know about Marx's book. It has been studied 1,000 times more by intellectuals and the Jews than by followers of the movement in the great working classes. In fact, the book was not written for the broad masses at all, but entirely for the intellectual leadership of the Jewish machine to guide them in world conquest. The Jewish machine itself was fired by a different fuel, the press. This is what distinguishes the Marxist press from our privileged class press. The Marxist press is written by agitators, and the privileged class press attempts to campaign using professional writers. The social democratic back-alley editor returns to his editorial chair from the meeting hall where he has gained an unparalleled knowledge of his customers. But the privileged class pen-wielder leaves his study to appear before the broad masses, where he is sickened by their smell, and finds his written words are useless to him. What has won the millions of workers over to Marxism is not the way the Marxist church fathers write. It is the tireless and tremendous propaganda work of 10,000s of tireless campaigners from the top all the way down to the smallest union official and the party delegate and the person who answers questions at the end of speeches. It is the hundreds of thousands of meetings at which these speakers, standing on a table in a smoky pub room, have hammered away at the masses, acquiring a wonderful knowledge of this human fodder, a knowledge that has enabled them to choose the right weapons to attack the stronghold of public opinion. It is the gigantic mass demonstrations and the marches of 100,000 men that have burned into the shabby little men a proud conviction that even though he is a poor worm, he is part of a great dragon whose fiery breath will someday send the hated privileged class world up in flames and bring final victory to the lower class dictatorship. The propaganda of speeches is what prepared the men and made them willing to read the social democratic press, so the press was the next step following the spoken word. In the privileged class camp, professors, bookworm scholars, theorists, and writers of every kind sometimes tried to speak, while in the Marxist camp, the speakers sometimes tried to write. The Jew deserves special attention, because his deceitful skills of twisting the truth and his cleverness made him an effective writer. but his true strength is in his abilities as a provocative speaker. This is why the privileged class newspaper world doesn't have the slightest influence on the attitude of the broadest classes of our people. This is also due to the fact that it is largely Jew-controlled and therefore has no interest in truly enlightening the broad masses. It is hard to overthrow emotional prejudices, subconscious beliefs or feelings, and replace them with other beliefs that depend on invisible forces and conditions for them to be accepted. The speaker who senses the mood of the audience well can judge all of these factors and adapt his message. He knows that even the time of day his speech is given is important in determining its effectiveness. The same speech, the same speaker, and the same subject have entirely different results at 10 in the morning, at 3 in the afternoon, and in the evening. As a beginner, I sometimes called meetings in the morning. I still remember a demonstration we staged in the Münchener Kindercellar as a protest against the oppression of German territories.
Münchener Kindl means Munich's child, the name of Munich's coat of arms.
At that time, it was Munich's largest hall, and it seemed a very risky venture. To make it easy for the movement's followers to attend and for everyone else who might come, I set the meeting for a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. The result was devastating, but extremely instructive. The hall was full, and the impression stunning, but the room was like ice. Nobody warmed up, and I was deeply unhappy at not being able to establish any relationship, not even the slightest connection with my audience. My speaking was no worse than at other times, but there were no results. When I left the meeting, I was completely dissatisfied, but one experience richer. Similar attempts that I made later led to the same result. This should not have surprised us. You only need to watch the performance of a play to see the difference in impression and effectiveness at 3 in the afternoon and the same play with the same cast at 8 in the evening. A person with a keen sensitivity and the ability to analyze this emotional state will immediately see that the magnificence of the afternoon performance is not as strong as the evening's performance. The same statement holds true for film. In the case of the theatre, it might be possible to say the actor does not work as hard in the afternoon as in the evening. But the movie does not change between the afternoon showing and the 9 in the evening showing. No, the time itself has a definite effect on the room, as well as on me. There are halls that mysteriously leave one feeling cold and somehow violently resist any generation of warmth. Men's traditional memories and impressions of a place may also decisively influence their reaction. A performance of Parsifal at Bayreuth will always have a different effect from anywhere else in the world. The mysterious, magical spell of the Festival Heights Opera House in the old city of the Margrave cannot be equaled or substituted by dressing up another opera house with fancy decorations. All these cases require the invasion of a man's freedom of will. This is the most true when it comes to political meetings. These meetings are attended by people who are already against you, people who have to be won over to a new purpose. In the morning and during the day, people's willpower seems to resist with the greatest energy any imposition of an outside will, and they refuse to recognize an outside opinion. In the evening, on the other hand, that willpower yields more easily to the dominating force of a stronger-willed speaker. In truth, every such meeting is a wrestling match between two opposing forces. A man of dominating force, a man who has the character of an apostle, and a man who is an outstanding speaker, will be the one who succeeds in winning over men whose resistance has already been naturally weakened. Their resistance is more easily overcome than those who are still in full possession of their force of will and their intellectual strength. The same purpose is served by the artificial and mysterious twilight of Catholic churches, the burning candles, incense, etc. This wrestling match between the adversaries to be converted and the speaker will gradually develop his wonderful sensitivity to the psychological requirements of propaganda, a sensitivity the writer will never have. Therefore, the written work, with its limited effectiveness on its own, is better used to preserve strengthen and deepen an already existing view or set of principles. Great historical revolutions have never been produced by authors, but accompanied by their written words. The French Revolution would never have happened through the discussion of philosophic theories. It had to find an army of troublemakers led by majestic demagogues who inflamed the passions of an already tormented people. Finally, the frightening, volcanic eruption that followed made all of Europe freeze in their tracks with horror. Similarly, the greatest revolutionary upheaval of recent times, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, 1917, came about not through Lenin's writings, but through the hate-stirring speeches of countless aggressive apostles, both great and small. The uneducated masses were not inspired to start the Communist Revolution by reading theoretical ideas of men like Karl Marx, but by the shining heaven promised to them by the thousands of agitators who were working for an idea. So it was, and so it always will be. It is just like our German intellectual class with their stubborn isolation from life to believe that a writer must be intellectually superior to a speaker. This idea is wonderfully illustrated by a review in a nationalist paper, which I already mentioned, which said that one is often disappointed when they see a great orator's speech in print. That reminds me of another review I saw during the war. It put the speeches of Lloyd George, munitions minister at that time, painstakingly under the magnifying glass to arrive at the brilliant conclusion that these addresses were intellectually and philosophically inferior. They were unoriginal, and their conclusions were obvious. I picked up a copy of these speeches myself in a tiny booklet, and I could not help laughing out loud at the way these masterpieces were able to psychologically and spiritually lead the masses. It left the ordinary German pen pusher completely blank. This man judged the speeches simply by the impression they made on his own detached nature, while the great English demagogue successfully influenced the mass of his listeners and the entire lower classes of the English nation as much as possible. From that standpoint, this Englishman's speeches were marvelous performances because they displayed an absolute astonishing knowledge of the soul of the lower levels of the common people. Their effect was, in fact, tremendous. Compare these speeches to the futile babble of a Bethmann Hollweg, German Chancellor until 1917. His speeches did appear to be more intelligent, but in reality they showed only the man's inability to speak to his people. He was a stranger to them. Yet the bird brain of a common German scribbler whose intellect has been stagnated by a scientific knowledge who does not understand the masses could only evaluate the intellect of the English minister by the impression that a speech intended to affect the masses made on his own nature. He naturally compared those speeches with the ones of a German statesman whose intellectual chatter fell on much more fruitful soil with the intellectual writer. Lloyd George was in genius not merely equal to a Bethmann Hollweg, but 1,000 times superior. He proved this by the way he formed and expressed his speeches so that they opened the hearts of his people to him, finally bringing the people to carry out his will absolutely. The very primitive nature of the language he used, the directness of its forms of expression, and the use of easily understandable elementary examples proved the Englishman's outstanding political ability. I must measure a statesman's speeches to his people by the effect they have on his people and not by the impression they make on a university professor. That alone is the measuring rod of the speaker's genius. Our movement was founded a few years ago from nothing. Today it is impressive enough to be bitterly persecuted by every enemy of our people, both internal and external. The astonishing development of our movement is to be attributed to the constant awareness and application of these conclusions.
tuned in to Radio Aryan.